Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. As promised, there's the music.
There is the music. Hello, I'm Kimberly Adams, and welcome to Make Me Smart, where none of us is as smart as all of us.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, the single topic du jour today, as promised. I guess Friday was the last time we talked about this. Maybe tomorrow, yesterday? I don't even know. Anyway, gas prices. Yes, they're coming down a little bit, and yes, everybody's hoping they fall more. But look, how come they got so high? How come they're taking so long? What's going on? Help, please. That's what we're going to do today.
Yes, indeed. We will get help because we all need it for a variety of reasons, not just to understand gas prices. But in terms of gas prices, at least, there are a bunch of economic, geopolitical factors that go into how much we pay to fill up our tanks, at least if you have a gas vehicle and you're not on board with electric yet. And a lot of them we don't really think about until something goes wrong and you're driving down the road and looking up at the 10-foot letters that say, 525 or something like that. Anywho, in order to help make us smart about this is Clark Williams Derry. He's an energy and finance analyst at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So when I go to fill up my motorcycle or Kai goes to fill up his minivan, what is the big driver?
No commentary on relative coolness of the two hosts of this program, let me just say.
None needed.
Good grief.
What are some of the big drivers of the prices that we're paying for a gallon of gas?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. There are some things, some components of a gallon of gas, the cost of gas, that are kind of fixed. I mean, I'm thinking here of taxes. Taxes are set by both, federal policy and state policy. And then there's the cost of getting the gasoline to the gas station. It's the cost of distribution and marketing. That's from getting the gasoline from the refinery to the gas station and then running the gas station. But more or less, even if all the rest of the gasoline were free, it would still cost about $1 in taxes and distribution and marketing costs just for gasoline. And then on top of that, there's two other big costs. There's the cost of crude oil. So the cost of the crude oil, well, that varies dramatically. I mean, from during COVID, people may have heard that oil prices in the U.S. briefly turned negative, which was crazy. That almost never, that had never happened before, where the U.S. crude oil price went negative. So it's really variable. It's sort of a roller coaster ride. You never know how much you're going to pay for in the oil markets. As soon as you think you have a bead on it, something changes and the prices skyrocket or fall. And then on top of all that, there's a cost of refining the gasoline. There's big refineries sprinkled around the country that turn crude oil into gasoline and other refined products like diesel or jet fuel, that sort of thing. And what's been really interesting recently is that the price that we're paying to refiners has been going up dramatically. And the reason for that is, well, frankly, it's the Ukraine war. It has scrambled the global supply chains. It's created sort of chaos in where oil and gas are sourced, because you know the U.S. basically blocked all imports of Russian oil and Russian products that are sometimes used as refinery inputs. Same thing in the U.K. And then recently, Europe has done the same thing. And so that is. Meant that there are some refineries that can't get access to their normal streams of crude oil, and the result is that there's been a scramble and sort of a bidding up of the price that the refineries that can get access to oil are able to charge for their services.
So is it fair to say that refining is a differentiator this time on high prices between this and other eras? I mean, you remember when gas was oil was $147 a barrel, and
exactly.
And so is refining the issue this time?
It really is. I mean, obviously oil prices are high right now, but they're not as high as they've ever been. That was, as you pointed out, in 2008, it was even more expensive than now. But what's different now is refining. There's been a lot of talk, a lot of sort of chatter about what's been happening in the U.S. refining sector. There's a little bit of a dip in refining capacity that happened in 2020, 2021, during the COVID pandemic, the depths of it. Basically, there are a lot of refiners that weren't making money because nobody was buying much gas or jet fuel, yeah. and so they shut down. There's actually sort of one refiner that in 2019 had a series of accidents, explosions, and other mishaps in a Philadelphia area refinery, and so it went offline. So there's been a lot of attention paid to the U.S. refining picture, but really what's happening globally is much more dramatic. We've seen declines in refinery capacity in Europe. And then Europe got a lot of its oil from Russia, and now it doesn't want that oil. Mm-hmm. And it also got a lot of refined products from Russia, and now it doesn't want to use that refinery capacity. And so it's the outflows of the Ukraine crisis that have created this sort of scramble for refinery capacity around the world, a replumbing of supply chains, if you will. And that is what has really boosted the prices for refined products and the amount that refineries can charge.
So you and Kai kind of touched on this just now, but there's this idea that this is not as expensive as oil has ever been, and yet prices got pretty high. And
yeah.
Now oil prices are down below $100 a barrel for the first time since April, and yet, nevertheless, gas prices are still relatively high. So what's up with that?
Well, there's this phenomenon in not just in oil markets or gasoline markets, but in commodity markets in general, called rockets and feathers. Rockets means that oil prices tend to skyrocket very quickly, move up very quickly, but on the way back down, prices sometimes sort of float down, they drift down like a feather. So rockets is quickly rising prices, and feathers is sort of slowly drifting down prices. And this is been a phenomenon that's been observed in a lot of different markets, that includes in oil markets. But I actually have taken a look at this, and there's a lot of talk about rockets and feathers in terms of, well, when oil prices rise, gasoline prices rise very quickly along with it. And then oil prices fall, gasoline prices fall more slowly. And so there's this idea that, maybe, the oil industry or gasoline refiners or somebody is sort of gouging the public. This may be happening, but it doesn't happen as much as you might think. If you look at over time, the history, there's a pretty tight correlation between oil prices or changes in oil prices and then subsequent changes in gasoline prices. The delay is not that much. That sort of feather is not, drifting down. It's a pretty heavy feather there. The other thing that to remember about this is that, a lot of this rockets and feathers phenomenon, this idea that oil prices rise fast and fall slowly, or gasoline prices rise fast but fall slowly, some of that is just a cognitive phenomenon. We notice when oil prices rise. We notice when, you know, gas prices are going up because, you know, it's pain at the pump. And of course, we notice because, you know, as you pointed out, you know, we see the price of gasoline everywhere. It's the one price. You don't see the price of milk, you know, all over the place. You don't see the, you know, the price of a loaf of bread or a pair of jeans or something like that. But you see gasoline prices everywhere. So we notice them. We're sort of keyed into them because it is the one price. And so for some people, it's like the one sort of economic indicator they pay attention to. When gas prices are up, you know, they think the economy is doing badly. But so because we have all this of our all this cognitive attention on gasoline prices, we notice when they rise, but we don't frankly, you know, pay as much attention when they fall. So at any rate, I think the rockets and feathers phenomenon is real, but it's just a small part of this overall sort of, you know, view that people have of gas prices.
I'm here to tell you, everybody notices now when they're falling. I don't get off the highway without checking the price at my local Shell station. Look, let me ask you about a supply question.
Yeah.
Oil is a global market, right? We all 8 billion, whatever it is of us, need it. What do you make of the arguments that some, mostly on the right, are offering when they say, look, we could get out of this energy price spike thing if only we would produce more. We could become energy and oil self-sufficient, and that would take care of all our problems. Do you buy that?
Well, frankly, I mean, the U.S. has never produced as much oil and gas as it produces right now. And the result has actually been that we have never been more tied to the global price of oil. There's just one market for oil globally. Well, actually, prior to the Ukraine war, there's just one market. Now there's kind of a two-tier market with, you know, Russian oil selling at a discount and everything else selling at a premium. But, you know, the price we pay here in the U.S. is the same price, you know, roughly that the market is charging in Europe and in Asia. There's just really one market. And, you know, the U.S. does export a lot of our oil, and we import a lot of oil. We import, you know, export a lot of refined products. We have gasoline and diesel, and we import a lot. And so we're really just part of this one big market. So anything we do on the supply side in the United States just kind of gets diluted across this giant global market. And, you know, frankly, the fact that we have, you know, we're producing more and more oil doesn't necessarily protect us from oil price spikes or what's happening in Russia or what's happening in Europe or what's happening in China. You know, really, like, it's, you know, essentially by participating in this global market for oil and gas, we have hitched our economy to a roller coaster ride that we don't have any control over, because, you know, as you know, we're all part of one big market, and a policy change in Beijing or, you know, a war in Europe, those have the same effects on our prices as if something had happened here in the U.S.
You know, and that's the argument that a lot of people advocating for less reliance on oil and more reliance on clean energy will use, that we're too tied up in this market that we can't control, not to mention, you know, the literal flames all over the planet due to climate change.
Right. I mean, so, I mean, I personally happen to have an electric car, and my fuel comes from a public utility. You know, I live in Seattle, and our electricity comes from Seattle City Light. You know, we're lucky enough here to, you know, where the public utility owns generating facilities. It owns some hydropower dams. We own the transmission lines. Now, I'm not saying this is a perfect system, but, you know, I have, you know, as a result of all that, I have a lot of more control over my energy costs than I would if I had a gasoline car and were basically subject to the whims of the global markets. If, in my opinion, I mean, you know, a shift from oil and gas to renewable energy is more likely to give us control over our prices. It's more likely to sort of insulate us and isolate us from the sort of the vagaries of the global market, and keep our prices in check and predictable in ways that you really can't do if you are essentially, you know, competing against wealthy Asian nations or European nations that, you know, suddenly have a supply or demand shock. You know, we are really at the mercy of a global market when we're relying on oil and gas. But when we are, you know, just, you know, producing our own electricity, you can't export that so much. And so we have a lot more control over our prices.
Clark Williams Derry, an energy and finance analyst at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. Thank you very much. I learned a lot.
Clark, thanks a lot.
Oh, of course. Thank you.
Take care.
I'm fine with driving a minivan, Kai.
I'm fine with driving a minivan. Let me just say, I'm fine with it. I'm kind of bored
What's
with it now.
What's the fuel
economy
on that minivan? I get
20.2 miles a gallon, which is egregiously low. Yes, I know, but
it's
a vestige of having four kids to haul around and a couple of dogs and, you know, whatever. And we just don't have that in the house now. So if you're in the market for a heavily used Toyota Sienna, you know, hit me up on Twitter. No, I'm just kidding. It's a joke. I'm not using this podcast for personal financial purposes.
Personal gain.
Anyway.
Oh, man. I was just saying to Clark before we hopped on that, you know, it's so weird to be having this conversation about gas prices with, you know, just these heat waves and just, you know, global warming literally banging us over the head all over the planet at the moment. And
the idea that we are not throwing in 1,000% on green and renewables and getting ourselves off fossil fuels as fast as we possibly can. See also my point yesterday about a certain senator from West Virginia. It's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. It's amazeballs, truly. Anyway.
And dangerous amazeballs that.
Yeah.
Flaming ones even.
Yep.
Okay, I'm done. Let us know what you think. Did all this make sense to you? Does it land with your understanding of the markets, especially that sort of consumer psychology part of it, of people paying more attention to the prices going up than down? And what surprised you? So our number is 508-827-6278, also known as 508-UB-SMART. You can also send us a voice memo at makemesmart@marketplace.org, and we will be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
All right, we're going to do some news. Ms. Adams, you go first.
Yeah, because mine are very related to the conversation that we just had. You know, he made a reference at the very end to sort of the bifurcating oil markets. It's generally one market, but now we kind of have two, yeah, with Russia being Russian oil being sold at a discount and then the oil market for everyone else. I saw this story in Reuters today where the national Iranian oil company and Russian gas producer Gazprom on Tuesday, today is Tuesday, wow, signed a memorandum of understanding worth about $40 billion as they are working more closely together. These are two countries that are under active and pretty severe sanctions by, you know, the United States and Europe and other Western democracies, and they're just taking their oil into their own arrangement, it seems, their oil and gas, I should say. So I noticed that. And then to the point about climate change and the senator from West Virginia, as you discussed yesterday, it looks like President Biden is getting ready to issue an executive order, potentially as soon as this week. This is one of those, you know, as Washington loves to do it, sources say stories that's being reported in multiple outlets, including the Washington Post. But this idea that now that Manchin has kind of, you know, torpedoed any chance, at least for now, of getting climate into this latest package, now they're turning to the Biden administration to do some sort of executive order, potentially declaring a climate emergency, potentially, you know, trying to limit drilling and, you know, directing more resources to, as you said, Kai, increase the amount of renewable energy that we produce in this country. But, you know, as with any time a president issues an executive order or tries to get things done in this way without Congress, it opens the door to several things. Number one, legal challenges, the inevitable lawsuits when you try to either do something or stop doing something in which there's any kind of lobbying effort that wants to weigh in, which there always is. So there's going to be lawsuits. And then, of course, if a different administration comes in, they can roll it back. And so I'll be interested to see what Biden tries to do or can do via executive order at this point to, you know, literally stop the burning. But I'm not too optimistic.
No. And I think your point about it being able to be undone by another stroke of another president's pen is it's the tell right there that this is not a sustainable policy. Sustainable in both ways.
Yeah.
Okay. So I've got two reasonably quickies. I just want to make people aware of them. Number one, I don't know how many people remember the beginning of the pandemic and one of the indicators that we all looked at and said, oh, this is very, very bad. And it was Apple saying that it couldn't source things out of China because the virus had started spreading there, and we had a supply shock thanks to, in part, Apple. This was like January before anybody was really, really serious about this thing. Well, now, lo and behold, here we have Apple again saying, things might not look too good in the future. They have said yesterday, I think it was technically, that they are going to slow hiring, slow some spending on some of its teams, not the whole company, right? But part of Apple, parts of Apple are not going to hire as much, they're not going to replace people, and they're not going to spend as much money because they fear an economic downturn. Now, does that mean a recession's coming? No. But Tim Cook runs one of the most valuable companies in the world, and he's a little worried. And I think that's just a thing for everybody to pay attention to. I just want to make sure everybody saw that. And number two, and oh my lordy B, are you kidding? Because I would be fired if this happened to me and I was running an IT department. So I don't know how closely you've been following the January 6th committee hearings. I know you have, Kimberly, but I'm speaking to the broader audience here, right? But one of the things that's been percolating the last couple of days is the inability of the Secret Service to provide to the committee text messages about President Trump's movements and actions on specifically the 6th of January. The Secret Service has said, oh, we were in the middle of an equipment upgrade and we can't find them. And the committee subpoenaed the Secret Service on Friday and said, give me the messages. And today, the Washington Post, Carol Lenning, who's incredibly well connected inside the Secret Service, the Washington Post is reporting that those texts are nowhere to be found, cannot be found on the cloud, cannot be found on servers, cannot be found anywhere. And oh, my Lord. Oh, my goodness. Are you kidding me? That's it. Very bad luck for the Secret Service.
I was trying to find, I saw something either in the Post or the Times where the National Archives is getting involved as well.
Yep, it was in the Post, same piece. Yeah, crazy.
This is...
Very bad.
This is so wild. Like, this is the Secret Service and the White House and the base level of, you know, document retention.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, stay tuned.
Astonishing.
Stay tuned.
Okay.
Let's mailbag do.
Yes.
Hi, Kai and Kimberly.
This is Godfrey from San Francisco.
Jesse from Charleston, South Carolina.
And I have a follow-up question.
It has me thinking and feeling a lot of things.
Okay, so I guess it was last week we were talking about digital coupons, and I went into great detail about my thoughts about digital coupons and couponing. So one of our listeners shared this hack.
Hey there, Kimberly. My name is Alex from Reno, Nevada, and I feel similarly to you about the data harvesting used in digital coupons. Fortunately, there is a way around this. If we all use the same phone number, it becomes a lot more difficult to track us based on our purchases. I use the phone number 867-5309, you know, after the 80s song, as you put your local area code in, and then 8675309. It works everywhere I've ever been, and you know, you can get those sweet, sweet discounts without that despicable marketing tracking nonsense. Thanks. Love the show. Bye-bye.
86753. Yes, anyway. Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know what? I just realized I had a different song in my head. I was thinking of the much older one, which was like, what is it, like Beachfoot 45789?
I don't know.
It was like a 50s or 60s song where they had like, you know how they used to have like words at the beginning of phone numbers?
Yep, you bet.
So this is good though. This is good. I also got a lot of people writing in saying you could use the White House phone number as a hack.
People doing that
and
too.
That's always in there, which, okay. Yep. I guess the White House is going to get all the bonus points.
All right, here we go. Here's another one.
Hey, Make Me Smart team. It's Ellen from Indianapolis,
hey,
the crossroads of America. And I was just listening to your recent podcast from Friday, thinking that it is not going to be long before somebody figures out how to hack those BMWs and get their seat heating for free, which I am totally in support of. By the way, late congratulations, Kimberly, on getting Make Me Smart. I love everything about you. You've got an infectious laugh, except for you have one major flaw. You don't like cheese. Anyway, keep up the good work. Thanks.
Bye-bye. I told you,
can't
people take that personally.
Can't win them all. Might drive a motorcycle, but you don't like cheese. Oh, well.
You know.
Oh, well.
We all contain legions.
Oh, my goodness. All right. As always, we leave you with this week's answer to the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew but then found out you were wrong about? Here you go.
Hey, this is Mac from Brooklyn, New York. I'm calling with an answer to something I thought I knew but later found out I was wrong about, and that's the fact that 99.9% of baseball cards are worthless.
Oh, yeah.
I was one of those kids growing up in the 90s who thought, oh, no, I should never throw away my cards. I had heard the horror stories of people who had thrown away their cards as kids and always regretted it, so I've held on to them for 25 years now. I go back to try to sell my collection. Turns out most of them are worthless.
Dude.
So it turns out baseball cards are not a good store of value.
Oh, my God.
And honestly, next step is trying to figure out what to do with the 18 boxes of cards I have in storage. Love the show. Thanks, guys. Appreciate you making me smart.
You just got to hit the recycling, Max, because,
You could do a lot of really cool craft projects with it. Like, if you're a sports person, you could, like, wallpaper your wall with baseball cards. It would take forever, but it would be a really cool look. Or you could, like, decoupage a table. You know what decoupage is?
I don't know what decoupage is, you fancy pants.
So decoupage is when you take, like, some sort of paper good, and you basically take a lot of glue, and you put your glue down, and then you put the paper product down, and then you put glue over it, and it, like, creates a like a veneer over top of it. I had these two research advisors in college for my undergraduate research project, and when I graduated, I decoupaged them pen holders with pages from The Economist because I'm a dork.
You are a dork. Holy cow.
And so, yeah, decoupage is fun. So find a good decoupage or wallpaper project for your baseball cards, or, you know, do something cool for a sports fan. Yeah.
There you go. Home crafty tips from Kimberly Adams on this podcast.
Yes.
My goodness. Send us your suggestions about home crafts or maybe what Max can do with his baseball cards. I don't know. Take your pick. Voice memo goes to our email at makemesmart@marketplace.org. You can leave us a message at 508-827-6278. 508-UB-SMART is another way to dial that. What are you doing? Are you crinkling paper to do a little decoupage right there? Is that what that is?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm doing. Prepping for my next project.
Yes.
Make Me Smart is directed and produced by Marissa Cabrera. Our intern is Olivia Chow. And our Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter, and she's amazing.
I wonder if she decoupages. Today's program was engineered by Juan Carlos Dorado. Mishin Siguan is going to mix it down later. Ben Talde and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. The senior producer is Bridget Bodner. Donna Tam is the director of On Demand and apparently everything around here as well. Marketplace Vice President and General Manager. Sorry, a little inside Marketplace joke. Neil Scarborough is in charge of everything. Of everything. He really is. It's him. It's Neil. Not Donna. For now.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.